Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in New York City and went to Georgetown University. He worked for Time Inc. for 36 years, and while there, was the publisher of Discover and later Fortune magazine. From 1995 to 2001, he was the CEO of Junior Achievement, and in 2014, he founded Detroit Homecoming to reach out to Detroit's expatriates to reconnect them with the city. Famous for his NOAA Awards, his name? Jim Hayes. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're with a modern-day Renaissance man. Jim Hayes. Jim, welcome. An honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. It's an honor to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Sure. I grew up in Manhattan Island, which was actually a wonderful experience. My father was an attorney in New York. My mother had come from Cambridge. My father was also born and raised in New York City. And you know, we did the things that kids do in the city. You know, we played punch ball. We played stick ball. We took advantage of the things the city had. We used Central Park, was free and clear. We lived right across the street from Central Park. I'd come home from school and go out and play in Central Park for 2 or 3 hours and come home for dinner. We actually had an absolutely marvelous time. It was all we knew. The only grass we knew was in Central Park. The games we played were uniquely city games. They were never played any place other than New York City. I had a wonderful time. We traveled around the city on buses, on subways, when we were little kids. I mean, the city was safe. It was, to me, an extraordinary growing up period.
Jim, what's the biggest thing you learned from Mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from Dad?
Well, that's interesting. From my father, who came from very, very humble roots, but ended up being a very distinguished, nationally prominent attorney, I learned to never give up. And that's really stuck with me all my life. He never said that to me, but he exemplified it in everything he did. And whatever success I've had in life has been pretty much because of that, because I just never gave up. I always try to figure out a solution to the problem that faced me, and I really take that from him, because he, again, from very simple roots to the top of the legal profession in this country, he was very smart, he was very hardworking, but he just never gave up.
And Mom?
Mom was very different. Mom came from a traditionally British background. My father was kind of the son of Irish immigrants. So my mother came from a very different background. She came from a kind of a Boston Brahmin background. So she was very elegant, and she had all the proper manners and the proper behavior. So I guess I've never really thought about what I learned from my mother, but now that you ask, I think, you know, manners, courtesies, proper demeanor, respect for human beings. I think that came from Mother.
In 1959, you joined Time Inc.
I did.
Paint for us a picture of Time Inc. in its glory days.
Well, those were the glory days. In 1959, Henry Luce, the founder, had a hugely successful Time magazine that had started in the 20s. He had a hugely successful Life magazine that had started in the 30s. Life magazine was the largest media outlet in the world. If you wanted to see what happened in the world, throughout the world, you waited till Life magazine came out and you saw it right there before your eyes. In 1959, he also had an outrageously successful business magazine called Fortune that had implications and following and influence all around the world, throughout the industrialized world. And in 1959, he also had this fledglingly new magazine about the world of sport called Sports Illustrated. And on a personal note, I read about Sports Illustrated when I was like 16 years old. I was a sports freak. And unbeknownst to the Yankees, I was supposed to be their second baseman. But I played a lot of tennis, and I was going to make my life somewhere or another in the world of sport. Well, then I read about Sports Illustrated in 1954 when it came out, and I was 16. And I said, well, gosh, if I can't play these games when I grow up, then I'm going to work for Sports Illustrated and stay as close to these games as possible. So that became my ambition. That was my focus. I wanted to work for Sports Illustrated. So in 1959, I hadn't finished Georgetown. I never finished college. I was kind of bouncing around New York City. And I had heard that if you go to Time Incorporated and you fill out an application for a job, you're guaranteed a 25-minute interview. So I, you know, as a flyer, I took my chances and I went to the Time Life building and I filled out one of these applications, and it was kind of crazy because there were no degrees and there were no published articles and there were no published books, so I just passed it. But sure enough, I was given this interview. And the man that interviewed, all I wanted to talk about was Sports Illustrated. That's all I wanted to do. I didn't want to talk about Time or Fortune or Life or... And I think the interview had never met anybody who was so focused on Sports Illustrated. So I was with him for an hour and a half. And at the end of the hour and a half, he sent me on my way. And he simply said, well, you know, there's really nothing here for you at this point. He didn't say, go out there and get some experience and then come back. He simply said, there's nothing here for you right now. So off I go. He called me the next morning at 9:15 to say something had come up at Sports Illustrated that might interest me. Come on back down to the Time Life building, which they did. And they had a need for a custodial guy for 30 days, puffing pillows, cleaning ashtrays, pulling curtains. And they said, would you be interested for 30 days? I said, of course I'd be interested. So what I was I was kind of the stage manager of a little presentation, a little show they had put together with a little set whatnot to introduce this magazine to the civil authorities and to the business leaders and whatnot. And they needed somebody to clean it up between shows. So that's what I did for 30 days. And halfway through that show, it was so successful in New York that they decided to take it around the country. And they asked me if I would possibly be interested in spending the next 6 months traveling the country, puffing the pillows, cleaning the ashtrays. I said, of course. So I spent the next 6 months traveling around America with the publisher and the general manager, the editor, which was my introduction to Sports Illustrated.
And 60 years later, he's still cleaning up.
That's it.
And for 36 years, he was with Time Inc.
But let me better answer your question, Jack, because I didn't really describe what Time Inc. was like in those days. Time Inc. was the epitome of journalistic excellence. We attracted and we could gather the finest journalists in the world. Everybody in that profession really wanted to work for Time Incorporated. Those magazines had such cachet, they had such stature, they had such influence. Everybody in that field wanted to work for Time Incorporated. It was the epitome of the journalistic excellence.
We're talking to Jim Hayes, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Jim Hayes, who in 1967 moved to Detroit. Jim, what do you remember about the first day in Detroit?
Well, the first day in Detroit, I arrived. My wife didn't fly, so we took a train into town, and we went to... we spent the first night at the Kingsley Inn, because before we moved into the house we'd bought, and it was a Saturday morning, And in the middle of the day, unexpectedly, my wife's father died back east, so we had to immediately plan to go back. And so we weren't watching television. We weren't listening to the radio. We were just preparing to turn around and go right back to New York or back to the east. And we drove to the airport, drove to the railroad station the next morning from the Kingsley. And I can remember there was just no traffic on the road. The highways were completely free and clear. And I did see this column of smoke that was billowing to the sky, and I had no idea what it was. It was substantial. And then when we pulled into the railroad station, and I loaded her on the train, and I said to this conductor, and I pointed to the column of smoke, I said, "What is that?" And he said, "Kids." And what it was the outbreak of the rebellion, the riot, the disturbances of 1967. So that was my first impression. And I, my first days here, we dealt with that. And my office was in the Fisher Building, and we watched the progression of the flames and the fire. And it was astonishing. And, you know, I would drive around town and I would see armored personnel carriers and tanks and troops. And it was extraordinarily difficult to believe that I was in the United States of America.
You had a 10-year stint in Detroit on the sales team.
Yeah.
And for many decades, Ford Motor Company has been Sports Illustrated's number one advertiser.
Yeah.
How did you make that happen?
Well, I didn't make it happen, but there was a guy on our staff who was a much older gentleman and a remarkable character. His name was Bill Curran. And I'm sure there are still some people in town who knew Bill Curran. And anybody who ever met Bill Curran remembers him because he's one of the most extraordinary characters I knew. But a very serious-minded guy above it all. And he was very, very friendly with the top management of Ford Motor Company. And he played golf with them. He had a great personal relationship with them. And through him and through his contacts at Ford, SI, you're right, became, you know, by far their largest magazine. Actually, the first time the Thunderbird was ever shown to the public was in the center spread of the first issue of Sports Illustrated. That was the first time it was ever shown to the public. But because of Bill Curran and his relationships and his... it wasn't just relationships. I mean, he took his job very seriously. Sure, he was friendly with the leadership of the Ford Motor Company, but he wanted to make sure that they understood why they were advertising to the extent that they would. He spoke with Lee Iacocca regularly. You know, the likes of, you know, Bill Benton, Ben Bidwell, Henry Ford, they're all part of his coterie of friends. And he made sure that when he talked to them about advertising and sports, that they knew why they were doing it. So it wasn't just give old Bill some more business. He made sure they understood why and how the magazine deserved it.
10 years later, 1977, you leave Detroit and go back to New York City. Why?
Well, I was transferred back by Sports Illustrated. I had a couple of jobs here. Then they moved me back into another position in New York. And New York, as you pointed out, was my home. And I had a wonderful time in Detroit. I grew up an enormous amount in Detroit. That was an extremely important chapter in my life. But it was time to go back to New York and continue my career in the publishing world with Time Incorporated. And I did. So I went back, and I never expected to be here again. I was gone. I was leaving. I was going home, and that was it.
In 84, you became the publisher of Discover, and then from 86 to 94, you were the publisher of Fortune magazine, that iconic biweekly. I would read it every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
What made it so special?
Well, because we worked very hard to make sure that we gave our readers, the management community of America and Asia and Europe, that we gave them something of great value. And the value we gave them was how to run their businesses better. We competed with Business Week and Forbes, and Business Week was a news magazine about business, and Forbes was a financial magazine. But we tried to be a practical, valuable business tool. We want to help you run your business better by understanding you know, what Jack Welch is doing, what the great leaders are doing, what Mike Cope is doing. And so we work very hard to make sure that we were giving them something of practical value to help them run. And it was a time when business books were booming. People were really crying out for, you know, how do I do this better? Internationally, and, you know, we had a lot going on in Asia, we had a lot going on in Europe, those communities viewed Fortune, and they were grateful to Fortune because through Fortune, they learned how business was done in the United States in the 40s and the 50s. I remember the first time I went to Japan, I couldn't believe it. I was treated like royalty. And it wasn't me, it was Fortune magazine and the respect they had for Fortune. And, you know, it's the same in Europe to a lesser degree.
In 1994, Al Gore invented the internet.
He did.
How soon thereafter did you realize that this tsunami would transform the print and magazine world?
Well, now here I have some regrets, Jack. I mean, I was part of a company and a community that didn't realize soon enough the impact that that tsunami would have. We saw it initially as a way to expose more readers to our magazine. And once we exposed them to our editorial product, they would want to buy into our subscription full rolls. But that didn't happen. A decision was made at one point early on to give them editorial material free. And that would lure them into our subscription rosters. But, you know, that didn't work. We gave it to them free. There's no way then to charge them for it. You know, it's, to use the expression, the genie was out of the bottle, and there was no putting it back in. So I don't think at the time, in time, we realized just how influential and impactful the internet was going to be. We saw it as a kind of a new technique for maybe selling subscriptions, but we had no idea the ultimate impact it was going to have and how people didn't want to wait until Friday or Saturday to get the news. They had it every single five-minute period right before them. And you know, the other thing is that we were so successful. I mean, and I don't want this to sound wrong, but we were really, those magazines were throwing off extraordinary. I remember I worked for Money Magazine for several years, and the profit margins at Money were 39.9%. That's a staggering figure. And, you know, Money Magazine was just kind of another magazine there. But the timing was just so extraordinarily successful. And that leads to or can tend to a kind of a comfortable, cocky outlook on life.
From 95 to 2001, you were the CEO of Junior Achievement.
Mm-hmm.
We've all heard about Junior Achievement. What is it?
Well, Junior Achievement is now 100 years old, and it basically teaches kids what business is about. It started, pardon me, as an after-school program in Springfield, Massachusetts, in 1919, and it was an after-school program where kids learned about it. They put together a product, they sold it, they marketed it, and they really understood the flow of manufacturing and how business operated. Well, gradually it moved into the classroom, and volunteer businessmen like me and like you would go in classrooms and teach kids about it. We would use the curriculum that Junior Achievement gave us, but we would go in the classroom and talk to kids about business, and it's had extraordinary success. Teachers love it because the business perspective is not part of their background, teacher's background, and there's a new face in the classroom that's talking about something new and different but very relevant to these kids. So the education community loves it. So right now, it teaches kids about business. It teaches them how free enterprise works. It teaches them about personal financial literacy. And there are over 4 million kids in JA programs today in this country. And there are 108 nations around the world that have JA programs in the country. So it's the largest economic educator in the world by far.
We're talking to Jim Hayes. And in 2013... after being gone 37 years, he decides to come back. And Detroit hasn't been the same since. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Jim Hayes, who, after being gone from Detroit for 37 years, very successful, in 2013, he decides to move back to Detroit. Hayes, why? That's, I'm sure your friends said, what the heck is wrong with you? Why?
Well, that's the question that was asked by scores of friends, and they worded it a little differently than that, but it was the same message. Well, I came back for two reasons. One, I have a daughter here. I have a daughter in Connecticut, I have a daughter here, and I have a daughter in son in California. And I thought I wanted to be closer to one of my kids. So I have a daughter here. But the underlying reason...
And she was the best cook of the three, right? No.
That's good. And the underlying reason was I had never lost my interest in Detroit. I had a lot of friends I had made, and I was fascinated to watch the ebb and the flow of the economic and the cultural ups and downs and ebbing tides of Detroit. I was fascinated by it. And then when things began to turn around and some really smart people began to work on it, I said, God, you know, I want to be part of that. You know, I knew a lot of the people who were doing the work or leading the Renaissance, whatever you want to call it. And I said, I want to be a part of that because I think that's incredibly important work. It's not just important for Detroit. It's important for this country. You fix Detroit, you have a leg up on maybe showing you can fix this country. So I came back and I wanted to find a volunteer opportunity, a role, and that's why I came back.
And you decided, who could I call that's influential that I think would buy me a lunch?
That's about right.
Most importantly, who would buy me a lunch at a nice place? So you called Keith Crane.
That's it.
What happened?
Well, Keith was a great old friend of mine when I lived here, and we stayed in touch over the years. And when I came back, he was very understanding that I wanted to find some volunteer role. He introduced me to a lot of people. And then at one point, I was talking to somebody, and this person mentioned, well, I always thought it would be interesting to do something with Detroit expats. So I looked into that, and I found out that Detroit has this extraordinary expat community. You know, people who grew up here, were educated here, but moved on to wonderful careers all over the world. And I said, well, maybe we can, you know, have a homecoming. I didn't go to Harvard, God knows, but I've heard my Harvard friends for years talk about their homecoming weekend, where they have speeches and parties, and the underlying message, contribute to Harvard. So I thought, why can't we do that for Detroit? You know, there's so much going on here. I mean, the iconic architecture, buildings, the history, the sports teams, the music. I said, let's bring back carefully selected expats, show them a wonderful time, bring them up to date with their city, meet the mayor, meet the governor, meet all the people who are doing stuff, and inspire them to do something for their old hometown. And that's what it's all about. You know, the words we use are reach out, reconnect, and inspire. And we say you can't come back unless you do something. You know, you got to do something either philanthropically or commercially for your city. And I am thrilled to report that after 5 years, the expat community has done extraordinary things for their city, their hometown.
And the fourth part of that little jingle, unspoken, is, and reach into your pocket.
Well, that's the inspire, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Luckily, Keith Crane said, well, let's go call in Mary Kramer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I brought this thing to Keith, and we talked about it, and I remember so clearly he swung his chair around, he looked at me, he said, let's do it. And then he said, I want you to meet Mary Kramer. And Mary Kramer is when this thing became real. Mary had the contacts, the knowledge, the reputation, the cachet, the friendships. She made it happen. And as I've said often, if it were only me, I'd be walking up and down Woodward Avenue on a sandwich board saying, come on home. But Mary really made it happen, and what she did is extraordinary. She deserves all the credit, and she does all the logistical work. She does 90% of the program work. She's a wizard. She understood it. She grasped the importance of it, the significance of it, and she took it to levels that were just unheard of.
Mary Kramer began working as a checkout clerk in her parents' five and dime store at age 7.
I don't think I knew that, but that's good to know.
She
Thank
joined
you.
Cranes in 89.
Yeah.
You know, she's the first female president of the DAC.
Yeah.
So she's made a lot of things.
Yeah, Mary's great. Mary's flat out great.
If you want to learn more, www.detroithomecoming.com. Speaking of homecoming, it's coming up in a couple of weeks.
Right.
This will be the 6th year. Last year, you had a big black tie dinner for a few friends, and you held it at this abandoned train depot for 1,000 people. Mm-hmm. What was that night like?
Well, I got to tell you, from the very beginning, and Mary will support me on this. From the very beginning, I said we should have our opening night at the railroad station. And they just scoffed at the idea originally. And I understand why. I said, look, that building's been condemned and forget it. But to me, to be able to do that would say so much about the renaissance of Detroit. Here, the train station had been the iconic statue of building of the greatest days of Detroit, but then it fell on hard times and became the symbol of the decline and fall of Detroit. But then to be actually have something there with business leaders and the leaders of the community, I thought it would be a great signal that the city is indeed on the way back. And it took 4 or 5 years, and the mayor ended up being extraordinarily helpful to us when he heard that. He said, yeah, we can do that. I'll help you with that. So it was a fulfillment of a dream. It was extraordinary. And people walked in there, and they were aghast. They were agog by what they saw. The beauty of the building, the fact that it still had this grandeur, this elegance that there was so many. It was a great, great night.
And with the light show on
the
the
light show.
Amazing.
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
Inspire, you know, reach into your pocket. What fruits have we seen from the first 5 years?
Well, I can put a number on that, the original purpose of the homecoming was to continue the momentum, the upper momentum of the city, and to generate resources in support of the activities already underway. We were not a new activity. We were there to support all the other stuff, and we connect expats to people who are doing great things on a small level, on a grand level, on a philanthropic level, and the number that we can point to now is well over $400 million of investment, of participation, of activity, financial activity that has been generated by the expat community.
We're talking to Jim Hayes, and I'm Jack Rasula. And this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Rasula, host of WJR's Anything is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible.
Anything is possible.
15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to Jim Hayes, who in 2014 he founded and turned over to Mary Kramer to make happen the Detroit Homecoming, to reach out to Detroit's expatriates to reconnect them with the city. On September 18th to 20th, we have our sixth annual. Who are some of the expats coming back?
Well, the expats come from all over the country, and you know they're carefully it's by invitation only, so we know exactly who we're inviting, and we invite people who have the capacity, either philanthropically or commercially, to do something of significance for their city. So these people. Many of them are very entrepreneurial, have their own entrepreneurships, entrepreneurial companies. Many of them have very interesting jobs for large corporations. A lot of high-tech people. We have a lot of real estate people. The names aren't important. It's their jobs. And we have bios on each and every one of them. And I've got to read all the bios tonight. They're very interesting people. But they have an emotional connection or bond to the city that is terribly, terribly important. And that's what motivates them.
A couple. Steve Case.
Well, Steve Case, he was the guy that invented AOL. And he was from Hawaii and, you know, was one of the early giants in the high-tech world. You know, his company eventually merged or was acquired by my company, Time Warner, and that deal is another subject for another. But Steve came away with a substantial fortune and has been very interested in entrepreneurship and helping entrepreneurs get started in this country. Great believer that entrepreneurship is the way to build the workforce of tomorrow. So he'll be, and I'm delighted he's coming. He's heard about the homecoming and has been a big fan and talks about it a great deal. He sees it as a critical economic development mechanism for a lot of cities. By the way, I'm going next week to Buffalo. They're starting their first homecoming. Last year, I went to Baltimore, where they launched their first homecoming. We're in conversation with Pittsburgh about how they'll launch their homecoming next year. El Paso sent a group of people in last year to see what was going on. So the word's spreading, and other cities are following suit. And Case, Steve Case, has really been enthusiastic about that.
All right. There's a man that's going to speak who's been in Plymouth, Michigan for decades. And Kwame famously told him to go back to Plymouth, take your $250 million. We don't want it for our schools. Bob Thompson.
Right. Bob has been an extraordinarily successful businessman. And all his recent adult life, he's been very concerned with the education of our young people in Detroit. And as you pointed out, you know, he offered a very significant investment to build charter schools in Detroit in the 90s. That didn't work for one reason or another. But he hasn't given up. He continues to start and fund a series of excellent charter schools in Detroit right now on a much smaller scale than they wanted to back in the 1990s. He's coming, and it's marvelous because, you know, you mentioned NOAA Awards. Yes. I've got to explain NOAA Awards.
That was my next question.
Well, I know. Well, we had this at Fortune, and it was no more prizes for forecasting rain. Prizes only for building arcs. In other words,
say that again.
NOAA Awards. They go to people. No more prizes for forecasting rain. Prizes only for building arcs. Stop talking about it. Do something meaningful about it. That's what that is all about. And Bob Thompson has built some arcs to help kids in Detroit get a better education. And I'm just delighted he's coming, I'm just delighted he's going to be part of the education panel during the week.
Hayes, God has really blessed you with the experiences you've had. It's unbelievable. If you could have dinner with two or three human beings who lived or are living these past 80 years, who would you have the dinners with?
Well, I'm glad you said the last 80 years. That's very important that you said that. I wouldn't mind my dinner to be fun. I'd want there to be a lot of laughter, a lot of energy, and I'd like the human spirit to be on full display at that dinner. But interesting minds interacting. Very interesting. I'd start with my dear friend George Plimpton, who did so
many. Joe Schmidt made famous,
yes,
right?
Yes, he helped make famous. He did. Right? But George did so many things. And, you know, he played cymbal and gong for the New York Philharmonic. He played quarterback for the Lions. And his ability to write about these things was truly gifted. He is, without parallel, the finest storyteller I've ever heard. And I've heard George tell some of these stories a dozen times, and each time they're masterful. So, I mean, he draws people out. He just loves to draw people out. So he'd be a very important part of my... Another guy who I think is fascinating is Mikhail Gorbachev. And Gorbachev is very controversial. I mean, he's reviled in his old country because he let communism collapse and he let the people down. But he saw the world in a very different way. And the way he saw the world enabled us to, working with Reagan and Bush, enabled us to end the Cold War.
And Pope John Paul II.
Absolutely right. But he saw that communism was economically and politically bankrupt, and he took the steps to change the world. He was very, very impressive guy. He was the first Soviet premier or president to go to college. All these other hacks, except for Lenin went to college. All these other guys, Andropov, Chernenko, and Kosygin, and Brezhnev, they're all political hacks. They never went to college. Khrushchev didn't even go to college. But he had the breadth of vision to see this thing is, we got to change this damn thing. And he did. And so I think he was an extraordinary leader and with an enormous vision about the world. So he'd be at my table. I'm a great fan of Muhammad Ali. And at one point, it was generally recognized that Muhammad Ali's name was known to more people on this planet than anybody else in the world. And he was a citizen of the world, and he traveled the world. He was incredibly conscientious and aware of his role of the ultimate leader in the African-American community. He was very, very aware of that and very sensitive to that. And it was a terribly important driving motive of his. Amelia Earhart might be somebody because I'm a pilot and pilots like to talk to other pilots. And if we had Amelia Earhart at dinner, we'd find out what happened to her plane. So it would solve that mystery. Another person might be Julia Childs because Julia Childs had enormous impact on how Americans view food. And I like to be a part of that. But she also was a person of great breadth. I mean, she did some OSS work during the Second World War over in Europe. And if we had her at the dinner, we'd be sure to have a hell of a good dinner. So that's my group, I think.
Jim Hayes, you are a quintessential example that life is a series of chapters. And God's got more chapters for you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much, Jack.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.